open your Bibles, please, to Ruth chapter 2, verse 19. You may not know this, but where the Mississippi River rushes out into the Gulf of Mexico or the Gulf of America, whichever you prefer, it flows at a rate of 600,000 cubic feet per second, and it drains an area of 1.2 million miles. That's a watershed that includes 33 states. It's a river that's 11 miles across at its widest point. It's ranked 15th on the list of longest rivers in the world. You'd think it'd be ranked a little higher than that, but 15th. Well, what this means, of course, is that from the shores of the Gulf, you know, standing there near New Orleans, you can't see the river's source from there. To do that, you'd have to trace it back some 2,300 miles. In the summer of 1999, I was a part of a cycling team from Simpson University. I've told this story a few times. We rode our bicycles from across the United States, from Portland, Oregon to Portland, Maine. It was a trip of a lifetime, so many amazing things from that trip. But one memory I'll never forget was crossing a little bridge on Highway 2 over a little stream in Minnesota, about 20 miles south of the Canadian border, and seeing these words printed on a bright green sign: "You are now crossing the headwaters of the mighty Mississippi." That great river emptying into the Gulf started there. Our text today is really, it's really a text about hope, a hope that comes because of the actions of a man named Boaz. But it's a hope that, if followed to its source, can ultimately be traced back to the headwaters of God Himself and His great reservoir of loyal love. It's a love that's so deep and so wide and so far-reaching that whether in life or in death, God's people can have the sure hope that it will never stop flowing to them and working to their good. What we see in our text today is that God's people can have hope because God's loyal love will never forsake the living and the dead. Let's remind ourselves what we mean. Some of you may not have been here, so let's remind ourselves what we mean when we talk about God's loyal love. We've explained in previous messages that the people of Israel were God's chosen people. That means that God was committed to them and responsible for them in a special way. Now, not because of anything special in them, we say over and over, but because of something special in God. It's the same reason that He is kind to you. It's not because of anything special in you, it's because of something very good and special in Him. What we're told in the Bible is that because of God's own great love, He chose to create a people for Himself and to separate them from the idolatrous nations around them and establish them with a covenant relationship, with them a covenant relationship. Quoting theologian Wayne Grudem, we defined a covenant as an unchangeable, divinely imposed legal agreement between God and man, in this case Israel, that stipulates the conditions of their relationship. God tells people how He wants them to act, and God also makes promises about how He will act towards them. And we said, if we had to sum up how God promised to act towards His people in the context of covenant, we said, no better word captures a summary of that action than the Hebrew word hesed. We'll see that word again in our text today, hesed. Maybe some of your translations in your Bibles are going to have hesed this way, as maybe loving kindness or mercy or covenant loyalty, steadfast love. Those are all very fine ways of translating the Hebrew word hesed. But for our series on Ruth, we've translated the word hesed as loyal love. We went on to say that the closest thing we have, I would say, today to a covenant relationship would be marriage. We understand marriage in a similar way. Two parties make commitments to each other, serious commitments. They require things of each other, at least we did when we made vows. And we made these vows, these promises about how we would act towards each other. And this is established with vows that explicitly state the relationship will remain fixed and permanent regardless of what? What do we have in our marriage vows? Well, regardless of profit or loss, regardless of sickness or health, regardless of better outcomes or worse ones, we commit to each other. This is a relationship that is going to last. And in a similar way to a covenant with God, if we had to sum up how each spouse promises to act toward the other in the context of this marital covenant, we'd have to say it's also based on a special kind of loyal love. I mean, I think that should be obvious that there's a difference between the kind of love and kindness that I owe to a stranger and the kind of love and kindness I owe to my wife, right? It's a different quality. It's a different level of love and kindness. Yes, I am supposed to show love and kindness to all people, but it's not all equal, is it? Or it shouldn't be, or you're going to be in trouble. There's a duty of care. There's an order of loves in which some love and care is by nature and by commitment more special than other kinds. Some kinds of love are meant to take priority over other loves and go the extra mile in duty and in action. And so, just as I'm committed to my wife and responsible for her in a special way that's different from how I treat others, a way that might be summarized as loyal love, so God is committed to his people and is responsible for them in a special way too, a way that is different from how he treats everyone else, a way that we've also summarized as loyal love, hesed. And the good news for us is that this loyal love of God isn't just reserved for Jews, it's for Gentiles too, for people like you and me too. If you're a Christian, it means you're one of God's chosen people too. The Apostle Paul writes in Galatians 6 that all who have trusted in Christ, God's Messiah, are considered the Israel of God. In Romans chapter 2, he makes it clear that a Jew is one inwardly, and what he means by that is that it's by faith that anyone becomes one of God's people. So that by faith in the person and work of Jesus, we are grafted into Israel, as Paul puts it in Romans 11. All who come to take refuge under the outstretched arms of Jesus have come to take refuge under the wings of Yahweh, the God of Israel. What that means is that we, who were once outsiders, have been included. We've been brought in and under the benefits of God's loyal covenant love. He doesn't treat you like an outsider if you're a Christian. He treats you like family. He treats you not like a foreigner, but like family. If you've trusted, if you've turned to Jesus in faith, that love that is now shown to you is so deep and so wide and so far-reaching that whether in life or death, we too can be sure that it will never stop flowing to us and working for our good. And that's great news. We too can have the sure hope that God's loyal love will never forsake the living or the dead. And in our story, Ruth can have that sure hope too, even though she's an outsider like us. Because she too has, we've seen this in chapter 1 and in chapter 2, we had it confirmed that she too has taken refuge under Yahweh's wings by faith. God has chosen to rescue her, to change her heart, to make her one of his people, and she has run to him in faith. And as a result, he has lavished his love on her with all its loyal benefits. And all of this is still dawning on Ruth and Naomi. We saw Ruth grappling to comprehend, last time we were together, she is grappling to comprehend such an avalanche of favor that has been shown to her. She was surrounded by it. We said she was surrounded by grace. And now today, we'll watch as it becomes sort of Naomi's turn to try to work out what this incredible thing is that is happening to her little family. Because Ruth has just come home after a single day of gleaning in the fields, if you remember, basically the can collecting of the ancient world, right? That's what we've said it's like. She's gone to earn money the only way she can right now. And she's come back with 30 pounds of grain. It's the equivalent of half a month's wages. So that after doing a double take, these are Naomi's first words to Ruth. Look with me now at verse 19. And her mother-in-law said to her, "Where did you glean today? And where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, "The man's name with whom I worked today is Boaz." I like how R. Hubbard Jr. paraphrases the astonishment in Naomi's double questions after her double take. He says it's like she's asking, "Where on earth did you glean today? And where in the world have you worked?" I like that. Remember, the last time that we heard Naomi speak to Ruth was back at the beginning of chapter 2 when they'd gotten to Bethlehem and Ruth just sort of looks around, sees the empty cupboards and announces, "Naomi, I'm going to glean." And, you know, Naomi's just so out of it and so depressed, all she can muster in response at that point is, "Go, my daughter." You know, that's it. But that was hours and hours ago. Surely Naomi has been concerned throughout the day. She loves Ruth. She's been concerned, wondering what's been going on with her daughter-in-law. Would her immigrant daughter-in-law be mistreated? Would she remember all the rules for gleaning? Would she have any success at all? I was talking with someone this week who he visits a certain European country many times on business, and I asked him, I was curious, I said, would you say there's anything distinctive that stands out to you about the people of that country? And he said, yes, almost immediately. He says, and I'm not going to tell you the country, but he says, they have a persistent pessimism about life. That was his response. And when I asked him, you know, why he thought that was, he went on to lay out a pattern of disastrous national events over the course of the last 80 years, the consequences of which are still being felt to this day. In other words, his guess was that there are routinely negative people about life because of routinely negative experiences in life. And I don't think that's super uncommon. I think we probably all know people who tend to be negative because it seems like lots of negative things happen to them. And I think it's the rut Naomi has probably fallen into as well. Remember, her words back in chapter 1 were this. This is sort of her worldview at this point. "Do not call me Naomi," that's her name, which means pleasant. "Call me Mara," which means bitter. "For the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me, and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me?" I mean, she sounds pretty pessimistic to me. And so even as Naomi wonders how Ruth's day has been going, my guess is that she's already picturing a worst-case scenario. She's sitting at home saying, you know, she's probably just expecting bad news. In our house, we call it horribleizing. You sit there and you just expect every possible bad scenario to happen. So that at first, I think she, you know, at first she's almost speechless when Ruth shows up triumphant with this huge bounty. And even when she finally does get her wits about her, Naomi, all she can do is stutter out the same question twice in two different ways. Where? You know, where on earth did you glean? Where in the world did you work? But I think Naomi really means, what she really means is who. I think what she really means is who is responsible for this, for all of this you've brought. And I think she means who because, remember, all the fields are connected to family. So she could ask where, but really she's asking a who question. Whose field did you go to? And she knows all the families. And so before she even gets an answer, she now does what one commentator compares to firing off an arrow in the dark. She doesn't know not who's to blame, but who's to bless. She doesn't know who it is, so she just fires off a prayer of blessing aimed at whichever family happens to be responsible for all this bounty. "Blessed be the man who took notice of you," she says breathlessly. So that even with these first few words, we, I think, can sense a change in Naomi's disposition. I think we can see a flicker of hope leaping to life from the smoldering wick that is her heart. "Now we hear a new word from Naomi's lips," writes Warren Wiersbe. "Blessed," or blessed. He says, "We have moved from bitterness to blessedness. Blessed be the man who took notice of you, Naomi says. Today in our text, we're going to look at three ways God gives this hope to Naomi's family, this particular hope, that his loyal love has not forsaken them, either the living or the dead. And the three ways he gives this hope is through the actions of a man named Boaz, even though Ruth hasn't named him yet. And so we start here with the first way God's loyal love gives hope through Boaz, which is that Boaz has providentially taken notice of Ruth. Naomi takes one look at all that grain, and she instantly knows that someone has taken more than one look at Ruth. Someone has noticed her. The sense here is that Ruth has stood out to someone in the crowd. And it's not that she caught someone's attention in a bad way, you know, because she's a foreigner or because she's a stranger or because she's an enemy of Israel. No, it's clear that she's caught someone's attention in a good way. And not just their attention and interest, but their kindness too, their favor. That she's been noticed means she's been singled out for special treatment. It's clear to Naomi that Ruth has fallen into someone's good graces. And what we know already that Naomi doesn't is that Boaz is this man, and that Boaz had already heard about Ruth before they met and about her loyal love towards his relative. How Ruth has taken care of Naomi after both of their husbands have died. And so my guess is that Boaz had been on the lookout for her already, trying to put a face to the name. I think as Boaz made his way to his part of the field earlier that morning, he was probably already looking out at all the gleaners and all the family plots, trying to discern which one she might be. I think he was already looking for her long before she had any ideas about him. In other words, I think Boaz noticed Ruth so quickly when he got to his own part of the field because he had already decided to look for her, to keep his eyes open for her. And of all things, there she was, right in his own part of the field. I wonder if he sensed God's blessing on their meeting even then. Blessed be the man who took notice of you, Naomi says. And Ruth, seeming to understand that the heart of Naomi's question is really a who question, not a where question, she now fills in the blanks for her mother-in-law. So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, "The man's name with whom I worked today is Boaz." It's interesting. Several commentaries point out that the Hebrew here is really funny because there's much shorter ways to say this. And so it's funny because the writer seems to have intentionally, purposefully, really drawn out the secret identity of who this man is. You know, it's like we know the secret, Naomi doesn't know, and we're all waiting for the big reveal. And so the writer makes, you know, he just draws it out as long as he can because Ruth doesn't say, "The man is Boaz." She doesn't say, "The man's name is Boaz." She doesn't even say, "The man's name with whom I worked is Boaz." She has like every extra word in there you can think of before she finally gets to his name. "The man's name with whom I worked today is Boaz." But the wait is worth it. I imagine Naomi's speechless and blinking face in surprise at this news, because remember, we've known about Boaz for a full chapter already. We were introduced to Boaz by the narrator back in verse 1, that he was a relative of Naomi's dead husband and a very important, powerful relative at that. And then Ruth was introduced to him back in verse 8. But what is easy to forget is that in verse 8 and after that, remember, Boaz never told Ruth that he was related to Naomi and her husband. He doesn't say that he's related. All he says, all he tells her, is that he's heard about her and what she's done for her mother-in-law. And so he wants to reward her for it. But Naomi, finally hearing the name Boaz, she knows, she's the only one who knows all of these connections. She can put it all together. And so all at once, for the first time, she's putting all the pieces together. So that, as one commentator put it, a thrill would have shot through Naomi's heart as that once familiar name fell upon her ears. Why? Well, because it changed everything that the man who has providentially noticed Ruth was this man. It meant there was hope for her family. And we're going to go on to talk about why that is in just a minute. But first, let's trace this new hope back to its proper source. Because why? Well, because it all traces back to the great reservoir of God's loyal love for his people. What Naomi instantly sees in this moment, I think, is that God hasn't forgotten or forsaken her family after all. Just the fact that Boaz has noticed Ruth is an instant reminder to Naomi that God is still taking notice of her and of her family. That is, that his covenant love still covers her like wings, and that gives her hope. And in his providence, God takes notice of you too. He singled you out for special treatment. It all started because God knew you, and he was on the lookout for you already, long before you had any thoughts about him. If you've put your trust in him, it's because he first decided to come looking for you in Jesus Christ. You may think it was purely your decision to go visit that church or to read that book or to listen to that sermon podcast, but it was God who put you right where he wanted you so that you could fall into his good graces, so that Jesus could find you, even if you thought you found him. And the reason he sought you out and found you was so that he could pour out his loyal love on you, because this gives him glory. It shows off his character. And so every good gift to you, every kind provision for you, every gracious blessing experienced by you is a reminder to you that God hasn't forgotten or forsaken you either, that God is still taking notice of you, that for his glory and for your good, his nail-pierced hands still cover you like wings. And that should give you hope. But now Naomi tells Ruth more specifically why this news about Boaz gives her hope. Look with me now at verse 20. And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." Naomi also said to her, "The man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers." Naomi seems to be doing everything in twos. She's probably done a double take at the site of Ruth's hall. She stutters a double question about where she's been working. And now, before she explains why she's so excited, she gushes a second blessing. "May he be blessed by the Lord," she cries out. I wonder if the way she says it surprises Ruth. You know, it's probably obvious by the way she says it that Naomi has recognized this name. In other words, her arrow of blessing this time isn't fired off wildly into the dark. Now it has a definite target, a man with a name and a face probably known to her since childhood. But the second half of what she says here is really interesting because the grammar makes it almost impossible to know for sure which one Naomi is talking about, who she's talking about when she adds this, "whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." So really quick, the word for kindness there is our word hesed, or loyal love, whose loyal love has not forsaken the living or the dead. But since both Boaz and the Lord have just been mentioned in this sentence, the reader is left to wonder, is Naomi talking about the loyal love of Boaz here or the loyal love of the Lord? Which is it? It's like me saying, you know, my son Sam and my son Nathan saw a huge buck on our hunting trip and he shot it. You know, if I told you the story that way, I guarantee someone would want to know, well, which one of them shot it? Who's getting the credit? And in the same way, the reader here also naturally wants to know which person is Naomi giving the credit to for a loyal love that has not forsaken the living or the dead? Is it Boaz or is it God? Well, I read all sorts of commentaries this week that really lamented such bad grammar on the part of the author, and then went on to make cases. You know, it seems like every commentary picked a side and made a case one way or another. You know, it had to be Boaz that this is talking about, or it had to be the Lord. But my question as I'm reading that is, what if this isn't bad grammar at all? What if the author wrote it this way on purpose? And I think he did. Because yes, even though these direct actions of loyal love come from a man named Boaz, if followed back to the source, all loyal love can ultimately be traced back to the headwaters of God himself. In other words, as we said when studying the doctrine of providence, God works in cooperation with his creation to bring about his purposes. And that includes working with and through someone like Boaz to lavish his favor on Naomi's family. And so as one pastor put it, we see that the lines between hesed that is given by God and hesed that is given by God's people, they begin to blur. God so often mediates his loyal love through his people so that even though loyal love comes from Boaz, it really comes from the Lord who gives it to Boaz to give to Ruth, to give to Naomi. Naomi has felt abandoned by God, but now she recognizes in this moment, in the actions of Boaz, she recognizes God's invisible hand at work behind the scenes. She's missed it up until now, but now she knows. She should have known it before, but now she knows that God has never left her. He's not forsaken her, and it gives her hope. But what about this loyal love gives Naomi hope for both the living and the dead, as she puts it? That's kind of an interesting way to say it. The clue is given to us in her next words. Naomi also said to her, to Ruth, "The man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers." Today in our text, we're looking at three ways God gives this hope to Naomi's family, that his loyal love has not forsaken them, either the living or the dead. And the three ways he gives us hope is through the actions of a man named Boaz. The first way was that Boaz has providentially taken notice of Ruth. And now the second way is that Boaz has the potential to redeem what's been lost to Naomi. What does that mean? Let's step back just for a second. I just want to get some historical background for this text, for the Old Testament. Maybe you don't spend a lot of time studying how Old Testament laws play out in the lives of Old Testament people. The Old Testament is full of gracious laws given by God for the provision of his people and for his land. In the words of one commentator, these laws were designed to reflect God's justice, mercy, and provision, ensuring economic, social, and spiritual restoration. Four such laws. I'm just going to list four of them. Four of these kinds of laws were the gleaning laws, the jubilee laws, the redeemer laws, and the leveret laws. What's fascinating about the book of Ruth is that we see all four of these special Mosaic laws in action in one short story. We see them all in operation, even how they interact with each other in a story. In other words, you know, it's one thing to read about the laws in like Leviticus and Numbers, you know, they're just in a list. So it's one thing to read about the laws that way. But what's really cool about this is that in this one story, we get a sense for how all four of these laws sort of interact with each other and how they play out in the life of an actual person. We've already talked quite a bit about the first one, the gleaning laws. As we said before, the Jewish landowners were required to harvest inefficiently so that the poor, the widows, the orphans, and the foreigners, those with no family plots of their own, could come through the fields afterwards and still have some produce left, some grain left to survive on. And that's how Ruth and Naomi were planning on surviving. But the second kind of laws we see play a role in our story are the Jubilee laws, maybe a little more indirectly. These were designed to keep family land in the family. These were designed in part to prevent generational poverty among God's people. So God divides up the promised land up between the tribes, and then Each family or clan within each tribe had a particular plot of land assigned to them, and that land was never supposed to be lost to the family. So let's say you're a Jewish man with a wife and two sickly sons. As it is, you're barely making ends meet on your small plot of land passed down for generations, but you're getting by. But then a famine hits. Nothing will grow. You have one, then you have a second year of crop failure. So that all your contingency plans now fail. All your reserves get used up. And so even though you try everything else you can think of first to provide for your family, in the end, all you have left to leverage for the sake of your survival is that little plot of land. And so it's either sell that or, you know, sell yourself into slavery, and you decide. It makes a lot more sense to sell the land and use the money to take your chances by taking your family somewhere else until the famine passes. Maybe you'll go to Moab. You've heard there's still food there. Let's say this man pulls the trigger on this plan. He sells the family land and he moves to Moab with his family. Here's the hope that that man has, at least at the very basis. One way or another, he knows that land should one day be returned to him or to his sons. He knows it will return to the family. Because in Israel, the sale of your land is only ever supposed to be temporary. In fact, according to the laws of Jubilee, the longest a sold family plot can remain in the possession of someone else is 50 years. And so the price the land could be sold for would reflect how many years were left before that 50th year rolled around again, called the year of Jubilee. In other words, if it was 45 years until the Jubilee, that land could fetch a hefty price. Because why? Well, because it promised the buyer at least 45 years of use. But if it was only 2 years until the Jubilee rolled around again, that same land couldn't be sold for as much because the buyer could only make use of it for 2 years before it had to be legally returned free of charge to the possession of the seller. Well, in case you haven't guessed it, I think this is what might have happened with Elimelech and his family. I think he calculated the risk of selling his family plot and then put it up for sale. Then some other man in Bethlehem calculated the risk of buying this field, weighing the uncertainty of how many years of famine remained against the uncertainty of how many years of potential yield remained in that land before the Jubilee. And apparently, he decided it was a good gamble, and so a deal was struck, and Elimelech and his family left town. But then something unimaginable happened. While away in Moab, not just Elimelech, but both of his sons die. So that suddenly he has no heirs. There's no one to carry on the family name. There's no one for that land to go back to and get passed down to freely in the year of Jubilee. Yes, Naomi is back in Bethlehem now, but she's getting older, and there's no hint that Jubilee is coming in time to return the land to her before she dies. Yes, there are other family members who can, you know, that they can go to, that the land can go to when she's gone, or who can buy it back so at least it remains under the ownership of the clan, the extended family. But still, there's a real loss here. You're meant to feel the real loss to this, a nest egg meant to sustain one particular family unit has been smashed. That's what you're supposed to feel here. And so this is where the Redeemer laws come in. Remember, Naomi has said, the man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers. The redeemer laws applied to several areas of life. A redeemer, in Hebrew it's goel, was a near relative who had certain duties towards the clan or to the extended family. And there's way more duties than we have time to talk about here. Some of them are really cool, and some of them are a little more boring, but I want to talk just about the three main ones that concern us. First, the redeemer was responsible, if financially able, for purchasing the freedom of a relative whose poverty had forced them to sell themselves into slavery. So say there was some Israelite and that famine came, and the last resort he had was to sell himself into slavery. So a redeemer could buy back his freedom. So that was one responsibility. Second, a redeemer was responsible if financially able to buy back the property of a relative that had been sold out of necessity. In other words, this redeemer could get the family plot back for them even before the year of Jubilee. So you wouldn't have to wait 50 years or maybe after your lifetime had ended. You could, if you had a wealthy relative, he could buy that land back for you. And then there was also a third responsibility that the Israelites of this time seem to have lumped under the duties of the Goel, the Redeemer as well, and that had to do with the leveret laws, that fourth set of laws I mentioned. The word leveret comes from the Latin word for brother-in-law or husband's brother, and that's because in Deuteronomy chapter 25, the Israelites were given an unusual law that basically said, if a woman was left a widow without sons by her husband, without male heirs, then the nearest male relative, ideally the brother of the husband, was to marry her. That way, the first son born to this new union could be the heir that man never had, the man who died. It was basically another way to maintain the property rights of the deceased man's family line. It was a way to make sure that man's name and family weren't lost. And so, what is Naomi's hope when she hears who this is? In what way might she see Boaz proving to her that God's loyal love hasn't forsaken the living or the dead? What's the hopeful question mark that's left hanging over Naomi's words that the man is a close relative of ours? One of our redeemers. I think it's this. I think it's the hope that Boaz might not just be the target of her blessing, but also the answer to all her prayers. That he might not only be the redeemer of their property, but also the redeemer of a family with no sons to inherit that property. I think Naomi sees in Boaz a potential husband for Ruth and the potential source of an heir so that her husband's name is left honored instead of forsaken. As far as Naomi is concerned, in Boaz is wrapped up really all the promises of redemption and restoration. And for us, that hope of redemption and restoration is wrapped up in another man that Boaz is clearly a picture of, the man Jesus Christ. This earthly custom, wrote John MacArthur, pictures the reality of God, the Redeemer, doing a greater work by reclaiming those who needed to be spiritually redeemed out of slavery to sin. Thus, Boaz pictures Christ, who, as a brother, redeemed those who were slaves to sin, those who had lost all earthly possessions or privileges in the fall, and those who had been alienated by sin from God. Adam, you know, once called the Son of God, left humanity alienated and far from God after the fall. Adam was like a son who died. And since we all come from him and were represented by him, it was as if we all died with him. In Adam, all die, Paul says. That means we were all cut off from God. It means we aren't born sons of God, but slaves to sin. But in Christ, our Redeemer, in Christ, who the Bible calls the second Adam, those who were far off are again brought near. In Christ, our Redeemer, many sons are brought to glory because Jesus comes and takes our place in the grave. He becomes the son who dies so that we can become sons who live. His death washes away the stain of Adam's sin as well as our own, and in rising from the grave, he raises us back forever into the good graces of God. And that's good news. Well, I'm not sure if Ruth has grasped yet all the hope here in Boaz that Naomi has. Regardless, Ruth seems eager to keep Naomi's change of mood going, and so she now adds this in verse 21. And Ruth the Moabite said, "Besides, he said to me, 'You shall keep close to my young men until they have finished all my harvest.'" That's not all Ruth seems to say. Wait until you hear this. Today in our text, we're looking at three ways God gives this hope to Naomi's family that his loyal love has not forsaken them, either the living or the dead. The first way was that Boaz has providentially taken notice of Ruth. The second way is that Boaz has the potential to redeem what's been lost to Naomi. And now the third way is that Boaz has promised long-term protection and provision for both Ruth and Naomi, right? Because what Ruth is blessed with trickles down to Naomi. And we've talked about this already last time, so I won't spend much time on it today. But basically, Ruth is explaining that this abundance that she has just brought home isn't a one-time thing. She's saying, this has been promised by Boaz. This is just the tip of the iceberg. This is just the first fruits. This is just the down payment of a whole season's worth of gleaning. She's been welcomed by Boaz, she tells her mother-in-law, to come back daily to enjoy the benefits of his grace. And I think this just confirms for her, for Naomi, that this isn't just some token kindness from Boaz. This isn't a fluke. This is something deeper. So that if Naomi's hope was humming before, now I think at this news, it's singing. Her night of sorrow with its fog of depression had broken into the dawning of a new day of joy, writes John Walvoord. Her night of earthly doubt has been broken by the dawning of new hope, writes John MacArthur. And friends, just as God can turn the tide of Naomi's bitter life, so he can turn the tide of yours. He can do it in an instant. Be reminded today that if you belong to Christ, he will never leave you. He will never forsake you. Be reminded that you also are always welcomed by God to come back daily to enjoy the benefits of his grace. Well, God is clearly at work, and Naomi can't deny it now. But she still wants to be wise, and so she now says this to Ruth in verse 22. And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young women, lest in another field you be assaulted." Chapter 2 ends with these words, "So she kept close to the young women of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and wheat harvest." That's potentially up to 2 months. And she lived with her mother-in-law. As this chapter comes to a close, I wonder, you know, what was it like for them that night? After all the hardship they'd faced in Moab, after all the famine, what was it like that night to lay down with this new hope running through their heads? Commentator James Morrison ventures a guess. He says this, "The hard thoughts which she had been tempted in the time of her anguish to entertain would be sensibly beginning to thaw and melt. And if one could have read the hearts of both as at length they laid themselves down to rest, perhaps the thoughts of each might have been found to be running in the strain of the words of a great descendant as he said and sang, 'Thou hast put gladness in my heart, more than in the time that their corn and their wine increased. I will both lay me down in peace and sleep, for thou, Lord, only makest me dwell in safety.'" Psalm 4, 6 through 8. Friends, you and I can lay down in peace and dwell in safety as well if we have turned to Jesus in faith. No matter what you're facing, no matter what the circumstances is, we can dwell in peace and in safety if we've turned to Christ. Why? Well, because it means that we too have been included in the benefits of God's loyal covenant love. That love that is so deep and wide and far-reaching that whether in life or death, we too can be sure and have the sure hope that it will never stop flowing to us or working for our good. We too can have that sure hope that God's loyal love will never forsake the living or the dead. Let's pray.